I wouldn't throw a party for you. I mean, I'd buy you a beer.
All right.
But, well, yeah, right. You were vote buying.
Well, no.
Conspiracy.
That would a.
No, I'd buy him a beer because I know he'd be sad to vote for Johnson.
That's right. Mm-hmm. But I'm thinking back to Austin Powers 2 now. So we just had Halloween, huge deal in my neighborhood. Sam, I think you were there one time. And,
I was.
No exaggeration, hundreds, probably thousands, honestly, of people, if you count the families who are walking around with the kids.
Mm-hmm.
And we had about 6 Ghostbusters. And what struck me as interesting about this was that they were all boys.
Mm-hmm.
There were no little girls dressed up as Ghostbusters, so they weren't inspired to dress up as Ghostbusters. And mm-hmm. apparently the boys are not in any way perturbed by the idea of having women as role models. You know, I know it's a radical thought, but it turns out that you can take a role model who is not the same gender and not think that that's weird. Well, who would have thought it?
Here's my question. Were they inspired by this movie?
I think you'd have to assume so. I mean,
what?
The original...
Here's my counter-argument.
Okay.
You have a whole bunch of... These boys' parents are millennials.
Well, that would have been true last year as well, and we've never had Ghostbusters before.
But the Ghostbusters thing did bring up this nostalgia for Ghostbusters.
Okay.
And so these millennial parents... or remembering a movie they did not see whenever it was released. and so they're dressing their kids up as Ghostbusters.
The first movie I ever saw in a theater was Ghostbusters 2.
You didn't see the original Ghostbusters.
Well, at least if I did, I don't remember.
Exactly.
I would have been 4.
That would be my guess. I don't think these boys were necessarily... I could be wrong. And it is possible they were... inspired by the antics of that hilarious crew of people I can't even think, like Megan McCarthy and then everyone else. But
Kristen Wiig. Leslie Jones,
yeah.
And Ringo Starr?
Yeah.
I think Ringo's the drummer, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Actually, I was in the store.
Cher was only there so they could turn back time.
That was a key element of the plot.
Right.
Actually, I was in the store the other day, and they had a display. Like, they had the movie in the back of Ecto 1 or Ecto 2. I don't know what it is in this one. And it had the plate on the back that said, keep back 200 feet. I thought that was good advice for enjoying the Ghostbusters movie.
Very good advice.
So we have a couple of items of follow-up, and one of them I need to be more drunk for, so let's talk about beer first.
All right, well, today I have a Kona Brewing Company porter called Pipeline, and it's brewed with Kona coffee from Hawaii, and I have to say it does have a nice coffee flavor, and I'm very much enjoying it and wishing I had another one queued up. Mike, what do you have?
I have the Shiner Oktoberfest. It's very good. It's a beautiful color. Nice taste. Got a little bit of crispness to it. I enjoy it.
I'm on a Raging Bitch Belgian-style IPA. Insert your own jokes here.
Trigger warning.
Trigger warning, yes. This podcast is not a safe space, as we're about to demonstrate. All right, gentlemen. You have my permission.
So today we're going
to... Let the blushing commence.
We're going to dive into two topics that Simon would love to stop talking about. And... I think it's best if we get the one that's probably not going to go away out of the way first today, which is robot sex.
We have not one, but two news articles to talk about concerning robot sex, which is very exciting.
Yes, it is. So the one that was about a new robot sex product. And this particular product promises to be more lifelike. Apparently there's going to be some sort of heating element that is going to make the sex robot warm. apparently it's going to have genitalia with some sort of functionality, that the specific functionality was not specified. But I think we can make a couple of basic assumptions about what likely functions are going to be available. And, you know, it's going to look almost but not quite like a human person. And something tells me that my guess is there will be more of these bot that are fembots than the more masculine counterpart.
Yeah, you know, I was kind of wondering about the heating element. You know, I'm not sure if
that's what you wonder about.
Well, you gotta wonder about these practical things. Did they team up with Samsung to come up with the battery for this device?
Is it made in Japan?
Is it made in Japan? Yes, yes. Is it like a toaster? Like there's a thing on her back and you push down and then you see the heating coils start to warm.
Funny you should use the word toaster, huh?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I don't know, but I'm guessing that what'll happen is that someday it'll be available on Amazon, and I will be somewhat aghast as I read the reviews. That's what I'm anticipating happening here.
Oh gosh!
So
the only thing worse than the product names is going to be the reviews on Amazon. I think you're going to want to click on the 1-star reviews first. But all right, so if we've got to talk about this, can we talk about the less horrifying part of this, which is what are the social ramifications of this? Because, I mean, I'm joking about is it made in Japan, but Japan famously is turning more and more towards celibacy. So, you know, the sex is on the fall in Japan. Mm-hmm. Is this going to further exacerbate this problem of delatching sex from relationships?
Yes. I mean, isn't it so American, though? I was just thinking about, like, how, you know, we consumerize everything. And we've turned sex into a consumer product along with everything else, you know? Mm-hmm. It's not real sex unless you have something that involves batteries or warming or cooling gels or something. And so, you know, this is the car of consumerized sex. This is the long-term investment, and that's horrifying. But
is there a silver lining here? Does something like this make pornography go away?
This is pornography. You could make an argument that something like this at least doesn't involve the direct exploitation of women. Mm-hmm. But it still will. Like, you know, what's going to happen is, you know, guys are still going to consume pornography with this. This doesn't satiate the addiction. This just furthers it. A guy's going to watch pornography and then go do stuff with his sex bot.
Or do stuff with his sex bot while he watches pornography.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, my guess is that at some point it's going to be, you know, not uncommon for men to want to have sex with their sex bot and their girlfriend at the same time.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
What if she wants to bring her sex bot into the bedroom?
Well, then my guess is that people are going to be very open-minded about that.
Yeah, and, talk about it's fair play, I suppose.
If you don't do that, then you're a hateful bigot. And,
right.
You know.
Oh, God, yeah, that day is coming, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yes, it is.
Yes.
Oh, gosh. That's been one of the things that's depressed me over the last few years, just how fast after Windsor they made that pivot to the transgender thing and how fast America jumped on board.
And, I mean, it's really interesting to see how right Humana Vitae is. Like, everyone, you know, as soon as it comes out, oh, this is ridiculous. This is ridiculous. But, you know, as stuffy as some of the language and, you know, as much of a criticism of as you can make with Thomistic thought and all that, it's this is what happens. We have delatched sex from procreation, and what do you know? It's not a good idea.
Right.
You know, it's just going off the rails.
Well, that kind of brings us to Westworld.
Mm-hmm.
And the ethics of sex in that context.
Help me out a little here, because funnily enough, I had mentioned Westworld a few episodes ago. I didn't realize they were remaking it. I've not seen it. I don't mind about spoilers, but give me a little bit of context. I'm assuming that it generally tracks the notion of the movie.
Well, basically you have a sort of adult playground set in the West, and people can pay absurdly large sums of money and come to this, I don't know, I guess you'd call it faux town or whatever, and just do whatever you want. You know, you can just have a good time and, you know, relax and enjoy yourself and see the sights and have fun, you know, talking and enjoying the company of the robots. Or you can shoot the robots because you just feel like getting some killing done that day. Maybe you want to have sex with the robots, and some of them are apparently designed to seduce you actively for that purpose. That's kind of the general setting of the Westworld.
And the other thing that I found interesting, yeah, I haven't seen any of the episodes of Westworld, but one of the things they talk about in the article is that another thing that occurs in there is what they call is rape, that you can actually go after unwilling robots or robots who aren't designed as prostitutes or stuff like that.
Hmm. Yep. And one of the interesting questions that it brings up is, you know, does that have the same moral weight?
Well, so what is the level of sophistication of the robots? Because things are rather different. Somewhere between my dishwasher and Mr. Data, it becomes rape, right? But where along that spectrum?
These obviously are extremely lifelike.
Well, they're lifelike in terms of, so in the original Westworld, Yul Brynner was the cowboy, and it really was all clockworks. I mean, it was very sophisticated clockworks, but it was clearly just clockworks. On a scale between that and Tricia Helfer, where do these fall?
I'm not sure. I haven't seen. But, you know, I'd argue that, you know, part of the thing that carries, especially from a Judeo-Christian ethics, part of the things that carries weight is your intent or your desire. And so whether or not these things, I mean, there's some mitigation because they're not real, but these things are actually remembering. Some of them are remembering, which adds to their how real they are. But I think a bigger thing is the fact that these things look and act indistinguishable from humans, and these people are going in there and committing horrific acts.
This is one of the, you know, the ethics things that comes up in Battlestar, that a season two episode, the first officer on the Pegasus observes, you can't rape a machine. And, you know, that feels very differently, again, if it's Yul Brynner or if it's, you know, if it's someone who, for all intents and purposes, certainly seems to be a sentient being. And, you know, again, I suppose there's this continuum, and it's tough to know where it leaves off. I mean, if you think it's a dollhouse, is a doll in that context a machine? The personality is programmed. The fact that the, quote-unquote, hardware happens to be organic rather than, you know, steel and wires, does that change the ethics of it?
One thing, I mean, in my mind, if what you're doing, if you're sitting there and you're saying, well, this could be considered rape, except for this fact.
Right.
Then it's what rape. You're doing is rape.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's a good way to look at it. I mean, all right, so explore it this way. So, take Dollhouse, but modify it slightly.
Mm-hmm. Explain Dollhouse real quick for the audience.
Yes, I'm sorry. I shouldn't assume that everyone is familiar with our Lord and Master Joss Whedon's every work.
All hail
the Hypno-Joss, that's right. Sorry, Joss Whedon, you can tell me who to vote for all you like. I'm not going to do it. Okay, so Dollhouse, the concept was that you have these people who volunteer-ish. There's an element of You know, it's a bit of a Hobson's choice in some cases, but in other cases they are genuinely volunteering. And essentially the technological leap that has been made is the ability to put or to copy a human personality onto a disk and then wipe the brain, essentially, and reassemble a new personality into that body. And wherever that personality comes from, whether it's constructed from real people, whether it's an actual whole other personality, there are episodes where, you know, character one is put into character two's body and so on. And, you know, there's a whole bunch of stuff about why this is being done and so on. But this is the technological leap that has been made, that we've essentially transformed a human body into a machine. It happens to be biological, which, again, this is where the, you know, how do you define a machine, right? You know? But in that, you're dealing with live human beings who have had their personality erased and, you know, and to some extent, and, you know, is there something going on that can't be removed, that can't be taken out, that, mm-hmm. You know, is there a soul that transcends and all that kind of stuff? But modify that slightly and say that you're starting with a cadaver, or say you build a synthetic person from components grown in a lab, whatever. So you take out, there was no human personality here. Mm-hmm. And you can imprint onto that an entirely artificial personality that has been programmed from scratch. And it I shouldn't even say personality, just a series of algorithms, like a simple if-then loop, right? Is that something that's susceptible? I mean,
so basically you programmed a really sophisticated sex bot.
Mm-hmm. That just happens to be biological. Is that looking at it completely the wrong way? Is the right question actually, at what point does it become capable of consent?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that's a better way to approach it.
You know, the fact that you're building a biological organism to circumvent consent says a lot right there. you know, the best case scenario, because the fact that it's biologically human, makes it pretty, that's very, that takes it more than just like a sophisticated masturbation device. Hmm. That takes it like a step further than that.
The what exactly are you trying to do here, guys, question is a pretty valid one to ask.
So I think it might be helpful to start from a different point.
Mm-hmm.
When we talk about the act of sex, we're talking about a physical component. We're talking about a mental component and an emotional component.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure we're necessarily talking about an emotional component anymore. I think this is Mike's delatching point.
Well, I actually think that doesn't delatch.
No,
as human beings, we're quite capable of being attached to objects. And indeed, we often are. You know, people wear lockets all the time because that has special meaning to them. And it may not even have a picture of a loved one. You know, that may just be an object that they really like. You know, you can see kind of I hesitate to use this word, but classic example of Wilson, the volleyball.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, Tom Hanks's character, you know, really invests a lot of emotional energy in this volleyball because that's all he has. And I expect that with a sex bot, that something similar would probably happen. That people would invest emotional energy in it in a way that's not quite the same, but not unlike the way that they would invest emotional energy into a partner, or maybe a better way of looking at it is if they had a pet. Mm-hmm. That level of emotional energy and investment.
Or the movie Her, for example, where you have a lonely guy who becomes attached to his AI on his computer, his operating system. Which again brings us back to the Japan thing, that if the reason that young Japanese are not having sex is not so much because they don't want to or because they don't want to form attachments, but because they just can't be bothered anymore, then maybe this is a way for them to find that. I don't know. Is there any scenario in which this is healthy? I think our working assumption is that this is all you know, the road to perdition. This is all just terrible. But I mean, is there any silver lining here?
Well, I think Mike already called the silver lining, which is that if we can move to a sex economy, if you will, in which women are taken out of the equation almost entirely because sex bots have replaced women or young boys in certain cases as the go-to option for people who want to consume sex in a very depersonalized way, then I think we could make a huge dent in the sex trafficking of actual people. Mm-hmm. And I think that would be the silver lining.
Hmm.
Now, I don't think that would take sex trafficking away entirely, but I think it would make a big dent, and that's at least worth thinking about as a positive if that were to happen.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's a silver lining. But to go back to my earlier point, there are the three aspects of the sex act, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we know that the emotional part will continue,
mm-hmm.
right, when you have a sex bot.
Mm-hmm.
Right, we're going to have some sort of emotional reaction, even if it's just a sex bot. The other part is the physical part. You know, when we have sex, there's the physical dimension, and part of rape is a physical aspect of rape. Then we have a mental aspect, right? What Mike was talking about, your intentions toward this robot or person who has a personality mapped onto their brain, whatever the case may be. And I would say that from a moral standpoint, if you are doing something to a physical body and the owner of that physical body has not given consent for it, and you're mentally intending to perform some sex act without consent, then even just those two means that you've committed an act of rape.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, it doesn't even matter if it's a sex bot.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if there's a body that you're violating the rule of consent on, and you're intending to rape them, then yeah, you've committed the act of rape in a moral sense.
Mm-hmm.
Now, whether that means that we prosecute them in the same way under the law, that's a different question, and mm-hmm. I'm not sure how we'll come down on that as a society.
Yeah, I mean, the Westworld thing does suggest the possibility for entrapment to a certain extent, but that this is a way to weed out the people that we want to keep a close eye on, we being the FBI or whomever.
It's an idea, yeah.
Yeah, I guess if you were to put people in an environment where they could do anything they want,
and then just see what happens.
Yeah. It would be at least instructive to find out about those people.
Yeah.
The Black Helicopter Brigade might say that it's, you know, it's a government plot to find out who needs to be rubbed out. Off to the camps you go, pal.
You know, just keep a very close eye on.
Well, you know, fortunately we have great re-education camps here in the United States.
Just tremendous re-education camps. Okay, so before we get to the election, then, can we do one item of happier follow-up so we can get
to
my horror? Tabby Star.
Yes.
Oh, Mike is so thrilled right now.
Aliens. I'm not saying
you
it's
have to
aliens,
do the hand gesture, Mike.
But, aliens.
Yeah, there you go.
Aliens.
The Chinese have a big new telescope that is joining the hunt. The hunt is warming up to find out what the hell is going on with Tabby Star.
It's very exciting.
It really
and
is.
Did you hear, on top of this, another group of researchers were looking at the light. The light emitted from stars, and they're looking for odd variations. There is this theory that very powerful lasers near these stars, if you shoot it out, it'll mess with the spectrum in a very unique way.
Okay.
And so they looked, and they found most of the stars in the sky obviously have a normal spectrum. But they found 214 stars that show this unique pattern, that show, instead of a smooth spectrum, there's spikes in certain spots that's unusual.
I'm not sure I quite understand the predicate. So the stars' output fluctuates if what is happening, if a laser is being fired near one?
The idea, like, you'd have your star, and then near your star you would have this laser that would be shining on and off very, very rapidly.
And why might we think that someone would do this?
To get attention.
I see.
For some reason.
That just happens to be pointing directly at us.
Yeah.
Yeah, that one's a bit tenuous, isn't it?
It is very tenuous, but it is interesting. They found 214 examples of this.
Correct me if I'm wrong, if I'm just fundamentally misremembering my physics, but wouldn't a laser be the equivalent of pointing a fiber optic at someone? It's a very directed, an extremely directed burst. It would, I mean, for it to be pointing straight at us, assuming it's not chirping SOS, SOS.
Yeah,
right?
I don't know if it's... I'd have to read... I haven't read the study. I don't know how exactly they're saying that they're doing this with... They would do this with the laser.
Yeah, I would think it would have to be a mighty big laser.
Yeah.
Right. Let me ask a question that they tackled briefly on the Hello Internet episode that I sent you, and I'm interested in each of your reactions, which is, suppose it is, right? There are these other civilizations an unimaginably far distance away, and it starts signaling in something that is recognizably language, whether we can interpret it or not. At this point, we have discovered alien life. There is life on other planets, but one, we can't communicate with it, and two, we can't go there, and three, they can't come here. What changes?
Well, we pass them a note that says, "Do you like me?"
Yeah.
And then give them an option. They can check a yes box or a no box.
What changes? Not as much as we think. Like, especially since the 90s, and I guess because of the whole UFO thing, we've had a lot of, like, there's been a lot of anxiety in the West about... What happens if there really is aliens? Everyone's going to panic and freak out, and there's going to be all sorts of stuff in the streets. And provided they don't, like, show up tomorrow in D.C., I think we'll be fine. You know, some cult will emerge, and, you know, ritually.
I don't know if emerge is the right word. I think the cults are already there.
They'll just grow.
They're just nascent cults.
Yeah, they'll grow slightly. I think it'll give some boost to some of the visionaries, the Elon Musks of the world, you know, the Elon Musk of the world.
Well, not necessarily, just a backdoor bit of follow-up that we didn't do last time because we're trying to... Dear listeners, we really are trying to get these podcasts shorter, I swear to God. But Boeing, immediately following Elon Musk's announcement that he's going to Mars, announced that they will beat Elon Musk to Mars. So now there's a legitimate private sector space race.
That's awesome. That is awesome.
That's great.
We might see, knowing that it is possible for life and advanced life to survive on other stars, we might see someone start seriously talking about the idea of a generation ship and maybe moving towards constructing a generation ship within the next millennia. I don't think anything huge changes immediately besides more people joining cults.
And Mike is really happy about reading the articles.
Yes, I am.
I mean, that point that I can't remember if it was Brady or Gray makes, it was something I'd never thought about before. There's always this assumption that first contact means first contact, right? That the scenario in which we interact, we meet alien life, is an interactive one. But there are several scenarios in which we just become aware that they're there and we've got no way to communicate with them or talk to them.
It's the most likely scenario.
Yeah, well, that is interesting. Incidentally, I would recommend two pieces involving generation ships. The Expanse, the Mormons are building a generation ship, which I thought was just a charming little touch. I don't know where they got the grace note that there were going to be Mormons going out to convert the Fuzzy Wuzzies, but that's just charming.
It makes a lot of sense, actually.
It does, yeah. Given their theology.
Yeah, absolutely.
We have to go other planets and we'll be gods there. Okay.
Makes sense, yeah.
But also Ascension, which was a mini-series, I think, that I think they hoped to develop into a into a show. I don't think they got picked up.
Oh.
But it was kind of infuriating because it didn't really have a convenient ending.
That was an extremely infuriating show.
But it was enjoyable for what it was. I watched it the second time, and it was one of those things that this is... I would like more, but I can enjoy it for what little mm-hmm. they gave us. Mm-hmm. Since the election's on Tuesday, we really should talk about the election.
Let's talk about our upcoming doom.
Yes. Yeah, so you know, obviously, yeah, the Day of the Dead is next Tuesday.
Yes.
I think you're being unfairly insulting to the legit Day of the Dead.
Yeah.
I happen to like Dia de los Muertos.
It's actually very fun.
No, it's called the Day of the Dead because that's the day all the dead voters arrive in Chicago.
That is true. All the graves emerge. Harry Carey goes to vote. Holy cow!
You know what? This year, I actually wouldn't mind if Harry Carey voted.
I was going to say, I'm not crying in baseball, you're crying in baseball. Right?
Guys, I can't believe it. We won the World Cup. Cubs win! Cubs win! Vote Democrat! Cubs win!
Yeah. Oh.
Yeah, I think I wouldn't begrudge him a ballot this year.
Yeah.
Especially if he just wrote in Cubs for all the for all the options.
Or write in Harry Carey, right? I mean,
the write-in is the Cubs starting lineup.
We could do worse, to tell you the truth. And we probably will.
Yes.
Any predictions? Anyone want to... I mean, we've had a terrible year for predictions, but...
I predict that I will really enjoy a beer on election day. That I can predict.
Yeah. I predict that I'm going to be sad. I'm going to predict that I'm going to wish that Cthulhu won.
Yes.
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 Why vote for the lesser evil?
Exactly.
Yeah.
I don't think we can rule out Smod at this point. I mean, granted, the telescopes haven't seen Smod's approach, but that doesn't necessarily...
Whenever Jonah Goldberg withdrew his endorsement of Smod, I think that really hurt his chances.
Oh, I missed that, really.
Chances.
Goldberg withdrew his endorsement
and got behind Mick Mullen.
So he
formally withdrew his endorsement of Smod because Smod hasn't delivered.
Yeah.
Smod delivers on Smod's own timetable.
Just like any other politician.
Yes.
Yeah.
Although, to be fair, Smod isn't interested in re-election. Smod is a one-time presidency.
Yeah, yeah. He talks about real change. Permanent change. But, you know, where is it?
I have not voted yet, but I am probably voting for McMullen. Mm-hmm. And in Indiana, more literally than ever, that vote will not count. Because Indiana has a policy that that only registered write-in candidates will even be counted.
Mm-hmm.
But I've been thinking about this, and I don't have a good answer. So I'm hoping that Mike, you as the resident political scientist, can kind of give some kind of coherence to this. But I was thinking, first of all, I want to bracket this by saying, I think we can separate out the moral utility of a vote from the practical utility of a vote. So forget all of the pious invocations of civic duty and all that kind of stuff. Take that as granted, right? You know, God is watching, God knows who you voted for, and God does care. Okay? Mm-hmm. All that is right. But I was thinking back to the 2008 election, where Obama won Indiana by what I think most people would agree was, you know, the paradigmatic close margin, right? He won 49-48, 1%. But nevertheless, that amounted to north of 28,000 votes.
Mm-hmm.
You could literally have nuked the dozen smallest cities in Indiana, actually probably the smallest two dozen cities in Indiana, the day before the election, and the result wouldn't have changed in the slightest.
Mm-hmm.
When you're talking about that level of votes, can we really meaningfully say that a vote counts when it only counts when it's aggregated with a lot of other votes, and by the very act of aggregation, the vote becomes fungible?
Try putting that on a bumper sticker.
Well, I understand. I mean, and the pat response rate is, well, but imagine if everyone thought that. Well, but imagine if everyone agreed with me on abortion. It'd be really easy to pass abortion laws. That just strikes me as magical thinking. Like, when your strategy is to rely on millions of other people to just magically change their behavior, that doesn't seem very realistic.
To me, the reason why people should vote, like, the real reason why people vote, and the reason why we're encouraging people to vote actually has very little to do with any of the practical reasons. In most places where you live, your vote for the presidency doesn't really matter. Voting as the highest good is very overrated.
I mean, maybe to sharpen it, let me put it like this. Because the McMullen vote literally will not count. It will not even be counted, right? But suppose I instead voted for Gary Johnson. Mm-hmm. So my vote would at least be counted, whether or not it would count.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It seems to me that Trump still wins either way.
Mm-hmm.
So again, I mean, the difference between these two, it seems it rounds to zero if it isn't zero.
Well, I mean, okay, so the practical argument for voting for Johnson is that it gets libertarians closer to the number that they need to receive federal election
matching
funds.
Matching federal funds, yeah.
To have more ballot access, to perhaps maybe one day share the same stage with the major parties. That's the practical considerations for voting for those things. I think, if you were to make a practical... Because I was going to say one of the things, like, if they would have not counted the vote for Evan McMullen but noted how many people wrote it in, there's an advantage to that.
Yeah, I was going to say, when you're dealing with raw total, I mean, this is the Hillary thing. I have been exhorted by several people on both sides, just suck it up and vote for Hillary. You know, if I can suck it up and vote for Hillary as a Bernie supporter, you can suck it up and vote for Hillary. I see that. But the main reason that doesn't move me is Rob Long's point on the Ricochet podcast, if you're still listening to that a couple of weeks back, that the popular vote total will have a utility of some kind independent of the actual result.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if Donald Trump wins the popular vote and loses anyway, then the world looks very different than if Hillary wins by a razor majority and again looks very different if she wins by a large majority. And so the best move for, people in, of my general politics right now is to make sure that, okay, she's going to win, but let's let her come into office with the smallest possible mandate.
Mm-hmm.
And in that regard, it doesn't matter who you vote for as long as it isn't her.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I mean, if you're dealing with the secondary effects of a vote, then, yeah, I could see that that has some kind of practical utility. But it just seems terribly difficult. We have this kind of pious invocation that, well, every vote counts. But the closest election that I can remember, other than municipal elections, like the closest statewide, because most of the significant elections, right, are statewide. The presidency is effectively 50 statewide elections. Was Coleman and Franken in, 2008, maybe? And that was still several hundred votes apart. And it's just like, okay, so I changed my mind on the polling station, on the way to the polling station. I was going to vote for Franken, and I say, no, I can't do it. I'm going to vote for Coleman. Or I get hit by a bus. I mean, it doesn't make any difference either way. I mean, the same, when you start dealing with an aggregation of this number of people, the behavior starts to average out, doesn't it?
It does. I think voting matters insofar as you're a member of a group which has collectively changed its mind for the same reason, which is why parties go after demographics rather than individual voters.
Mm-hmm.
Because what you want to do is cobble together these big groups of voters who will vote for you rather than any one person, because ceteris paribus, one vote doesn't make a big difference to your election results if you're either one of the parties.
let's talk about why do people say, because if we all can agree that every vote doesn't count, that most votes don't really from a practical matter.
Well, at least the marginal utility of it rounds to zero.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Why do people say every vote counts? What's the idea behind that, actually?
To get people to go out and vote.
Okay.
I think it's just a pious fiction we tell people, because this is the video that you circulated, that we want people to go out and vote because in the aggregate it matters, mm-hmm. and there is no aggregate. Mm-hmm. Except maybe there kind of is. The aggregate doesn't have a corporate personality of its own, but it's something nevertheless more than the individuals. But that's the only way we can persuade, or this is the conventional thinking of how we persuade people to go out and vote. It may be wrong.
Mm-hmm. I think people use that argument because generally we like to hear that our actions matter, mm-hmm. that we've made a difference. And so if somebody tells us that our vote makes a difference and that it really matters, then we're more likely to engage in that behavior because we think that it's a significant behavior.
Mm-hmm. I was thinking about that, the same point, but from a different angle. So the video that you circulated, the Nerdwriter one, posited that, or I think reported, I should say, that when you tell people that the election will be close, and so their vote matters more, that doesn't actually help turn out nearly as much, mm-hmm. as telling them that it's going to be it's going to be a blowout one way or the other. And so you'd think that people would then respond to that by taking the view, well, it doesn't, my vote's going to matter less, and so they would say, well, what's the point? I don't feel as invested in it. But actually the opposite seems to happen. And I'm thinking back to the Brexit vote, where the allegation of the Remain people afterwards was, well, a lot of these people voted to go because they wanted to protest the man. They wanted to stick it to the system, but they didn't actually believe that their vote would count for anything because they figured that, they're going to lose. So it's just a protest vote. And so, is there anything to that, that people are more apt to vote when they think that it doesn't matter?
Well, because what I'd have to look at with that thing the Nerdwriter quoted is the number of people voting does it increase evenly on both sides? Does it increase the side that thinks it's going to be a blowout, or does it increase the side that thinks they're going to lose horribly? What does it increase? Because a bit of a story, I know my grandfather would always vote for the person he thought he was going to win the election. Not who he liked more necessarily, but rather just so-and-so's going to win and going to be win big, and so I'm going to go out and vote for them.
Just want to be a part of it, man.
Exactly. Yeah. And so there's this, I think that's the reason why if you tell people it's going to be a blowout, you see an increase in turnout, because people want to be a part of a movement. People want to be a winner. You don't want to be a loser. You got to be a winner.
Personally, I love losing. It's great.
I was going to say, isn't that the essence of being a conservative? You're basically going to get stomped on your entire life and lose your causes one by mm-hmm. one. It's much like being a Cubs fan now, I come to think of it.
Yeah, but the good news is, as a Cubs fan, eventually, right? Eventually it works out for you.
I don't say it's a perfect analogy. Do we want to finish up by talking about Lucy Brenton? Because I've not voted yet, so you may yet be able to sell me.
I don't really plan to sell you on this, Simon.
Okay.
No. I wasn't expecting to sell you on it, but I was hoping to spark an interesting discussion, which it did.
Which we did.
Do we want to talk about that?
Sure, let's talk about that for a little bit.
Sure. So I was reviewing the candidates for the various races here in Indiana, and I was looking in particular at the governor's race and the Indiana Senate race. And I took a look at, for the governor's race, Holcomb, because I really didn't know much about Holcomb. I mean, I've already looked at John Gregg before, because mm-hmm. he's run before. Mm-hmm. But Holcomb I didn't know about, so I checked out his site. And and then I also looked at Rex Bell's site.
Rex Bell being his libertarian candidate?
Yes.
Okay.
And then I looked at the Senate race, and the libertarian for the Senate race was Lucy Benton. And so I kind of just, you know, went through her issues page one by one on the issues, and I found that she had a very interesting thing in her issue description on abortion that reminded me a lot of something that Justice Scalia had said before, which is that the Constitution doesn't say anything about abortion. It doesn't really offer us anything on abortion one way or another. Mm-hmm. And that was, you know, Scalia's being very consistent about what the Constitution said or didn't say. Mm-hmm. I mean, it would have behooved him personally if he were to say, well, yes, the Constitution totally says we have a right to life. Mm-hmm. But, you know, he didn't.
He pointed that out in speeches, that both sides want you as a judge to settle it. You know, there are people out there who insist that, you know, clearly abortion itself is unconstitutional, because there are a lot of things that the Constitution directly criminalizes, right? Mm-hmm. Because it says right there in the 14th Amendment, life. Clearly that's what they had in mind at the time, right? You know, life in utero, liberty and property, you know. what does property in utero look like? I don't know. Anyway, sorry, please continue.
You get your first iTunes track while you're still in utero. Yeah.
Apple is working to monetize that space, I promise you.
Yes, I'm sure it is. It's the next Apple ecosystem component.
So you forwarded it to us, and so besides that, her position is she doesn't believe.
She's personally pro-choice.
She thinks abortion is a horrible thing.
Mm-hmm. Personally pro-life, politically pro-choice, I believe is that phrase.
But she doesn't support any government.
I believe that it's murder, but I don't think it's government's role.
Any government regulations. And so I could see what you're talking about with the Scalia reference, but I think there's a key difference between Scalia as a judge saying the Constitution doesn't say anything either way, mm-hmm. and so therefore I have to be, you know, I can't say there's a right to life.
Right. He said that it's a legislative question, properly speaking.
Yeah.
In the case of Lucy Benton, because she's going for an elected office, which is a legislative office,
exactly,
then she becomes involved in the legislative process. With regard to any federal legislation that would come up with regard to abortion.
The F word is the key one, because I think that his point would be, and you see this in the Carhart case, that generally speaking, it becomes a state legislative matter, and she's running for a federal office, which I think is your major point, that, you know, that look, you know, she's not going to, in the mine run of cases, federalism is going to supply a rule of decision whenever she gets a bill. So, for example, take the federal partial birth abortion ban, which was at issue in the Carhart case, but what was at issue was its congruence with Casey, not its congruence with the Commerce Clause. And Justice Thomas concurred with Justice Scalia joining him to point out that, look, just as a procedural matter, we're not saying that this bill is okay. We are answering the question of whether it passes scrutiny under Casey. Which their answer and the majority's answer was yes. But, and this is, I mean, I kind of think of it in a slightly different way from Mike, which is, I love it between the three of us, there are at least three different perspectives on things. This is always a lot of fun. Usually it works out that it's two against one on these things, and that's also fine. But to me, there are several bills where, or several instances, where that doesn't control. Because, for example, the spending power. I think even libertarians at this point have accepted that insurance is interstate commerce. What was it, the Southeastern Underwriters case in 1950?
You'd be surprised.
And so on. Oh, well, all right, fair enough. But, you know, you can correct me on this in a moment. But, you know, generally speaking, most people agree that regulation of insurance is a regulation of interstate commerce, and have done for, you know, 70 years at this point. Even I accept that insurance is legitimately a regulation of interstate commerce, and I would overrule everything back to an EC Knight, right? I would literally turn the clock back a century. But there are things bills that could come up, that could reasonably come up, things involving the Hyde Amendment and so on, where the federalism question doesn't supply a rule of decision. And maybe there are other libertarian principles that she doesn't mention on her webpage that would answer the question. But federalism doesn't answer that. And so if that's not supplying the rule of decision, well, she's going to fall back, it seems to me, on either some other principle, or she's going to fall back on her own personal opinion, which is what, is sort of the port of last resort. So you, I suppose, are going to say that, well, libertarians just wouldn't want the government regulating insurance in the first place, right?
Well, many of them wouldn't. That's not true of every single libertarian candidate, by the way, but many of them wouldn't. Mm-hmm. In the case of the Hyde Amendment and federal funding for abortion, libertarians are very loath to provide federal funding for any sort of private activity. And that includes activities that everybody in America would agree are good activities. Many libertarians wouldn't support federal funding for orphanages, for example. Even though everybody thinks having a place for orphans to live after their parents have been killed is a pretty good thing to do, right? Not a lot of, people opposed to orphanages out there. So, in general, I think it's very unlikely for libertarian candidates to decide that on an issue that they recognize as controversial, that's a private activity, that they're going to say, yeah, we should federally fund that. That seems really unlikely to me, given the principles they generally operate under with regard to how we decide what gets federally funded. So I think it's very unlikely that you'd see a libertarian candidate say, yeah, okay, federal funding for abortion, because they're unlikely to say federal funding for anything else.
But, okay, so, the first bill comes up. And it's an appropriations bill, in the way these things are done these days. Unfortunately,
it's
an omnibus spending bill, right? It has this line item in it that's not Hyde amendmented, so to speak. Ted Cruz filibusters it. Does she join the filibuster?
That depends on what's in the bill. The problem with omnibus bills, mm-hmm, generally, is that the very few libertarian candidates we've had have generally voted against omnibus bills, just because in an omnibus bill, you're very likely to do something that libertarians don't like. Likely to hit something where a libertarian says, the federal government shouldn't be involved in that, or the federal government shouldn't be funding that, or, that violates the principle of liberty in some other way, right? Personal liberty, the right to personal property. Right, those kinds of things. You're almost always going to hit something that a libertarian doesn't like in an omnibus bill. It's basically unavoidable the way most bills are written.
Yeah, the omnibus thing is one thing that both sides surely should be able to agree we've got to address.
Yeah, it makes it really hard for any group of political representatives to come to any kind of common ground.
Right.
Because there are so many points of failure, mm-hmm, in an omnibus bill. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it becomes a power transfer to the executive, which surely libertarians and conservatives can both agree is a problem, because you saw this in the food fights over, shall we fund Planned Parenthood and so on, and because we're dealing with bills that fund all kinds of activities, we should never be in a position where to deal with defunding Planned Parenthood we have to seriously debate should we shut down the Parks Service. Mm-hmm. That's just silly. Right, there's no logical connection between these two appropriations. Why are they in the same bill? And the thing that frustrates me about that, this is a tangent from Lucy Brenton, but the thing that frustrates me about that is that it would be within the power of the House to fix this tomorrow. You just say, okay, guys, we have passed the budget for the USDA. Tomorrow we're going to take up the next alphabetical agency, and we're just going to go through them one by one. Here you go, Mr. President, go ahead and sign it, right? They could fix this. The only reason that the omnibus thing keeps happening is because the House keeps passing them.
Well, do you think that's because it makes it easier for them not to read it?
Yeah, probably. I mean, this is one of the things that I find... The diagnosis that powers the Trump people is not wrong, right? The political class in Washington is a disaster, of feathered nests and all this kind of stuff. It's the remedy that's the problem, not least because it will end up with, you know, that least feathered nest of all politicians, Hillary Clinton, ending up in the White House, right? You know, I don't think anyone could seriously accuse Hillary Clinton of being in any way personally corrupt. Her or Bill, they are just the paragons of lily white, good government progressivism, right? You know, I mean... So that's my problem with Lucy Benz, that there are issues where just recourse to the federalism principle will not supply a rule of decision. It's not bad, but I don't expect there to be too many constitutional amendments banning abortion coming up. But that would be another example. I mean, federalism doesn't supply a rule of decision on that. Subsidiarity does. Mm-hmm. Right, but this is where the distinction between those two things does some work, but it doesn't happen very often.
Yeah, where I think federalism really matters is the Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. And the reason I say that is not just because of the abortion issue. I mean, that's part of it. I think the reason we get a lot of court cases wrong these days has to do with not a proper understanding of federalism being applied in the court. Mm-hmm. And... one of the reasons that I tend to like voting for candidates who do have at least a roughly decent understanding of federalism is that I want a candidate who, in a Senate confirmation hearing for a new justice, is going to push for a justice who will actually apply the standards of federalism in a way that at least kind of makes sense. Mm-hmm. You know? I know y'all are not huge fans of Anthony Kennedy, but at least he thinks about federalism. Mm-hmm. You know, that's one of the good things about Kennedy is at least he generally thinks about federalism. There are some obvious exceptions. You know, I wrote about this a while back that he clearly wasn't thinking about federalism in the Windsor case.
I would say that he wasn't thinking clearly about federalism ever. This is the problem. I mean, you know, you go back and read like Alden against Maine and. His concurrence in Lopez, and it's just such a jumbled grab bag of thinking. It's like it comes out in the right place, but it's tethered to, I mean, it's interesting you bring up Windsor, because, I mean, it's tethered to this same notion of personal dignity and liberty and so on. I mean, talk about, you know, we should never psychoanalyze any public office holder from thousands of miles away, but boy, that guy's just a bag of tells. I mean, you know, this anthropomorphization of the state and the attribution of it, of, you know, that everyone needs to have their personal dignity and, you know, the state has to have its dignity. It's like, man, I think a psychologist would have a field day with that guy. You know?
Yeah, they might well. But the reason I would want more people like Anthony Kennedy on the court is because if we don't have people who can at least get the federalism question right most of the time, then a lot of other stuff gets screwed up.
I have to congratulate you on saying something that no one has ever said ever before, which is, we need more people like Anthony Kennedy on the court.
Well, you know, I'm nonpartisan, so that helps.
Yeah.
So one of the reasons that I think federalism is important for the abortion issue, for example, or things like abortion, human cloning, same-sex marriage, bathroom laws related to transgender persons, that sort of thing, is that if you don't have a court that thinks about federalism and acts on it, then these sorts of questions inevitably end up on the court, mm-hmm. and the court will inevitably deal with them. And usually they're not well equipped to deal with those questions. Mm-hmm. And so they'll usually deal with them even more badly than a legislative branch would, because at least the legislative branch would either have to just bow to the will of the majority, mm-hmm. or they would have to do the work of researching and persuading, mm-hmm. to get a majority. Mm-hmm. Whereas the court is simply not subject to those constraints. Mm-hmm. So... I think on the abortion issue, if we want to see major movement on the court, I don't think it's going to be from conservatives overturning Roe v. Wade. I think that's, frankly, a pipe dream. that conservatives have had for a while. Mm-hmm. The reason I think that is conservative justices are loath to overturn precedent, particularly well-established precedent. So the longer this goes on, mm-hmm. the less likely you are to get a conservative justice who's going to overturn it. And if we're going to have anything push back against Roe v. Wade, it's going to be a principled case from another direction, which seems to be most likely to be federalism. Yeah. Or that gets devolved to the states.
But how does a case via, how do you link a, because you're saying a case not related to abortion, but related to federalism goes to the courts, ruled certain way, and that's going to affect Roe v. Wade?
Long term, yes. So let's say you have a buildup over 20 or 30 years of cases that go to the Supreme Court, and we have justices that actually think about federalism and apply the standard of federalism in their decisions. Mm-hmm. And then another case comes up, 40 years later, that says, okay, we have to decide, whether or not this particular statute is constitutional. And then federalism gets applied in an abortion case. And that kind of forces the court to rethink, we've got all this abortion law. What if we were to apply these standards to all of these laws and precedents that we already have about abortion? Then you might get some movement on Roe v. Wade, not because somebody just overturns it by fiat, but because you can actually articulate a rational principle by which you can roll back some of these things that the justices have done, that we now decide, given the principle of federalism, this was probably not a wise decision on the part of the court, and so we're going to push back on a few of these things. I think that's how you make real legal progress on two fronts. One is actually applying the federalism principle, and two, getting moral issues pushed back to the legislative branch where they belong.
Mm-hmm. I tend to think that the first step towards any kind of progress is for it to stop creating new constitutional rights. I mean, I suppose the problem I have with that analysis is that, again, this is where federalism and subsidiarity are not quite the same thing. Even the most dedicated federalists agree that the federal courts should enforce federal constitutional rights. It doesn't matter how powerful you think the states should be. Everyone agrees that a state can't create a statute that is just flagrantly an equal protection violation, for example. Hmm. And so as long as you have the idea that something is a federal constitutional right, it won't matter how much we retrench the commerce power of Congress, for example. Even if you gave me four more votes and I wrote the opinion on the commerce power of Congress, that would be a bloodbath the next morning, wouldn't it? The New York Times would call me all kinds of horrible names, right? But even if I got my way and we did go back to E.C. Knight, that wouldn't analytically bear on whether the court ought to enforce the 14th Amendment bar on state legislation prohibiting abortion, such as it is, right? I mean, Roe is singularly murky about where its supposed right actually lies.
Yeah, the right to privacy.
Right, exactly. And, Griswold, whence it drew that, is equally indifferent, not even murky. Casey, which actually sets forth the standard that's actually applied, is unambiguously a substantive due process opinion. It makes very clear that abortion is a 14th Amendment federal constitutional right, and so states can't infringe on it. So even if I could get my five votes for my Commerce Clause, Congress can't do any of this stuff, then the next case that you're positing comes up, and it's like, it doesn't matter, though. It's nice that you've got this Commerce Clause opinion, but we're not talking about the Commerce Clause. We're talking about a state that is infringing a constitutional right. And so we can either talk about whether that's a constitutional right, or we can apply the standard. So you may be being a bit optimistic there.
I probably am. I don't think that I'm any less optimistic than most conservatives about overturning Roe v. Wade, but sure.
Well, you know, I mean, the go-to examples are Swift against Tyson and Plessy against Ferguson, right? I mean, Swift was on the books for nearly a century before it was overruled. Plessy was on the books 50 years and change. So, you know, I mean, Roe's been on the books for longer than Plessy, but less time than Swift. Sometimes the court, quote-unquote, I mean, again, this is an anthropomorphization problem, but sometimes the court realizes that it's got it wrong, which is to say that the current crop of justices think that the old justices were dummies. They wouldn't put it quite that bluntly, but this is what's fundamentally going on. Yeah. You know, this is what Erie Railroad says, basically. Story was a dummy. We're going to do it different.
Yeah, well, here's what I think is actually going to change the legality of abortion. I don't think federalism's going to do it, and I don't think overturning Roe v. Wade is going to do it. What I think is going to happen is we're going to improve our technology to the point where the age of viability is basically conception.
Yeah.
And I think that's the point at which the law was just going to be like, well, this isn't happening anymore, so we can kind of toss this one out.
Yeah, I mean, this is what's pushed back the ethical thing. Stepping back, and this isn't a partisan point, and maybe you can tell me if the numbers have changed since I last looked, but it seems to me that young people are far more pro-life and getting more so by the generation, not because of some kind of, you know, fundamental persuasiveness of the pro-life case, but because of that picture of a child in utero sticking its finger out through the incision and holding the surgeon's hand. You know, that picture alone that came in, what, late 80s, was worth more in propaganda value than a billion arguments and all the rationality in the world. And the same thing, it's like as the viability goes further and further back, and you have preemies born further and further and living, it's like, okay, so you're saying that it moved 6 inches, and so we could kill it before and we can't kill it now. It's like a minute ago and 6 inches ago, it wasn't a person, but now it's a person. I mean, young people aren't dummies. They look at that and they say, this is just stupid, right? And so I assume that the same thing will continue, that same kind of relentless calculus will continue. It won't win elections, but it may change the culture. Now who's being optimistic?